Davos, the super-exclusive annual gathering of the world's political and business elite. It displays all of the features of a petri dish of the spread of crony capitalism. A tiny number of extraordinarily powerful individuals that meet to discuss how the affairs of all 7 billion human beings should be planned and coordinated. It represents an environment for the growth of regulation, intervention, and enhanced barriers to entry for small businesses. All too often, what we see in criticisms of capitalism are actually examples of rent-seeking and corporations trying to game the system, which amounts to crony capitalism. But has crony capitalism, like that displayed in Davos, become a catch-all term? It no longer focuses purely on cases where cronies have prospered by taking advantage of political connections. Attacks on crony capitalism too frequently devolve into attacks on capitalism itself. In reality, the real cronies are typically not CEOs, rather they cut a sympathetic figure. In many cases, crony capitalist outcomes are the result of lobbying from consumer groups. Take Ofgem's non-discrimination condition, which banned energy companies from charging consumers less in one region and more in another, which resulted in less competition and higher margins, hitting the poorest in society hardest. The challenge for free markets and for capitalism is manifold. The message is tarnished, the frames are poor, and fundamentally, the moral case for what they achieve is missing. I'm Darren Grimes, Digital Manager at the IEA. And joining me to discuss this challenge is the IEA's Director General, Mark Littlewood, and the Director of the IEA's Freer Initiative, Rebecca Lowe. Hello to both of you.
Hi.
Now, I want to start by asking you both, why does Davos make us, and I mean people on all sides of the political spectrum, feel so uncomfortable? And I'll start with Rebecca.
It's funny, I was just thinking about this a bit. I think it's a mix of things. Partly it's just kind of the weird kind of celebrity kind of unsettling nature. You've got kind of inherited wealth. You've got Prince William hanging out with, you know, Bolsonaro, who's been talking about being pro-torture. I mean, it's just a very uncomfortable kind of, these guys are having a party. I mean, I read the kind of the playbook diary thing that morning, one of the mornings, and, you know, it's all about the kind of the party scene. And I think that just makes us feel inherently unsettled. Part of that is possibly, I think, an inaccurate sense of opportunity cost. It's the idea that these people are spending all this money to get there, they're having these lavish parties, why don't we just take that money and spend it on curing cancer? And I think that's probably incorrect, because it's not like these people are just saying, I want to spend X money and you can have it for whatever you want. They're doing it for their own reasons, because of reputation. So it's partly that, partly just the mix of politics and business always feels a little dodgy. There's sort of worries about corruption and inappropriate. It's kind of Adam Smith about people, you know, seldom meeting except, you know, even for merriment and diversion, except for kind of conspiring against the public or contriving to raise taxes. So that's kind of that thing. At the same time, I think probably particularly for people on the left, maybe, and I'd suggest also for some of us on the sort of the freer side of things, is that there's a missed opportunity in terms of the idea of people choosing to come together for the common good. There's this idea that if you go back to something like the UDHR or James Ruggie on business ethics, this idea of people choosing to come together rather than going for some binding solution, like kind of legally binding idea, and maybe because of reputation and saving face, people are going to do good things for the world. But instead, they're kind of partying and hanging out with despot dictators, and that's a shame.
Mark?
I'm not really sure what the public impression of Davos is. In fact, ahead of writing a newspaper article about it, I desperately fished around to try and find some sort of opinion poll data about whether people thought it was a good thing, a bad thing, a terrible thing, a crooked thing, and I couldn't find it. So I can only really give my impression. And to read in, which I think is dangerous to some of the mainstream media coverage, that does actually reflect public opinion, and I'm not sure it does. But to me, it comes down to, Rebecca's touched on this, a kind of question about what exactly are they cooking up at this place? You know, what you've got, you know, hugely influential people from a whole range of fields meeting each other. Philosophically, my nervousness is the sort of theme seems to be, how do we centrally plan planet Earth? Whatever they actually say their topic du jour is, that's basically what they're talking about.
Shaping a global architecture.
Exactly. So what exactly are they cooking up? And I do think in these times of, I'm not trying to be too conspiratorial about it, but in these times in which the sort of political establishment has never been more loathed or distrusted in my lifetime, then I do think, just if you like, in the newfangled terminology, the optics of politicians and businessmen gathering together in this remote sort of Swiss ski resort looks bad and raises an eyebrow about what the hell is actually going on there.
And you mentioned trust in politics. I think you both might disagree with this, but I think the icon for crony capitalism has to be what happened a year ago with the collapse of Carillion. Now, that was a vast firm responsible for hundreds of government contracts that mistreated its subcontractors, neglected its pension schemes, and systemically cooked its own books. It damaged the idea of private firms delivering public services and revealed jaw-dropping failures at the heart of our business and political establishments, which goes to the heart of why people hate Davos so much, right? Because it's this idea of people getting together, the business and political establishment. But I want to ask you both, what does this tell us about crony capitalism in modern Britain 1 year on from Carillion? Do you think any lessons have been learned, Mark?
Very few. There's a real challenge and a dilemma for people of a free market persuasion here, I think. And I don't know the answer to it, but I think I know what the dilemma is. And that is, how do we want to treat the second best option of contracting out? I suspect the three of us want large tranches of the economy that are presently run by the state to be wholly run by the private sector. But if we can't get that, and you have a government department or the National Health Service or the school system that need, I don't know, some new IT project, or hospitals need to be cleaned, for example, are we going to say that that all has to be done by state bureaucrats, that they can't actually go to a private IT company to improve their computers, or a private cleaning company? They can't use a private taxi service to move people around. They've got to build their own cars and have state bureaucrats. And I'm loath to go down that route. But if we go down the route of actually saying the government has the money to do this, knows what it wants, but is now going to contract in Carillion or somebody else, well, you do risk that poisoning the well, because the state it's inefficient at most things, but is chronically inefficient at giving out contracts in a sort of business-like way. So costs, IT costs famously always sort of zoom through the roof on any government project, but largely because the government keeps changing its mind. Here's the initial spec, set it up like that. Oh, 6 months later, we forgot to tell you we need it all plugged into this as well. The costs soar. It looks like that IT company is then getting rich on the back of taxpayers. So I don't know how to crack that problem, because my first preference would be to privatise things rather than to contract things out. But I think if you rule out contracting out to private firms, you have made us an even more statist economy, not a more free market one.
There's a fantastic example that I read this morning about registering... having your status clarified as an EU national, your right to stay in the UK. And the app to do this is only available on an Android phone.
Right, if you have an Apple, basically,
there'll be a queue of people trying to get access to an Android phone, which I think really hits home your point.
So Bulgarians, Romanians, Spaniards, French, come on, come all. But yeah. iPhone users, no way.
Right, Rebecca?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think, unless you think, you should have a farm on every school. I mean, okay, I'm being facetious slightly. But it's crazy to think that anybody, even the most staunch nationalist, is probably going to accept that some stuff you're going to have to either buy in or you're going to have to sell out. I mean, this is just, it's the general kind of confusion about whether nationalism is about owning something or about who profits from it or who delivers the service. And all too often we have this very kind of... sort of Manichaean debate where it looks like you're kind of bashing these people against each other. And those of us on the side, like Mark says, who really thinks that there are loads of areas where the state would be a lot better getting out of it, and that would provide better services, it would also give us a chance to make choices for ourselves. We get lumped on the side of kind of the dodgy state franchising system. I mean, it's the classic thing with the trains, where the only bit of freedom is or choice is when the state chooses its chosen person. I mean, it's a monopsony. This is not something that we guys should be supporting. And calling state outsourcing of any sense, so an idea of kind of radical free markets, is hilarious. I mean, I genuinely think it's funny, but all too often I think people on our side because of that, exactly that thing that Mark's talking about, you know, kind of wanting to make the best of a bad situation, kind of adhere themselves to that. And I can completely understand it, but I think we've got to be really, really careful not to suggest that that's what we think is going to be the best way of sorting this out.
The Cameron government made some steps in this direction to make it easier for small companies to get contracts. But the basic problem is this. There's that old adage, isn't there? There's four ways of spending money. If you're spending your own money on yourself, mm-hmm. you are highly sensitive to both price and quality. If you're spending your own money on somebody else, buying Aunt Mabel a present, well, you're pretty sensitive on price, but you're a bit less sensitive on quality. If you're spending somebody else's money on yourself, well, you're still very interested in the quality of what you're getting, but you don't give a damn about the price. It's mm-hmm. somebody else's money. And government falls into the fourth quadrant, spending other people's money on other people, at which point you care neither about the quality or the price. And somehow or other, we've got to find a way of if we're not going to move to full-blown privatisation for reasons of political feasibility in certain areas, how we try and make government behave a bit more like one of the other quadrants and less like that fourth quadrant of, well, it's somebody else's money, I'm not the end consumer of this sort of, why does it matter if it costs 150 quid for a light bulb? Those disciplines aren't there.
I think that's right. I mean, I think there are loads of things you want to take into, or you might take into consideration when you're just, you know, just sort of deciding how a service should be delivered. So it might be like transaction costs or efficiency, ease, all of these things. And I think there are questions about efficiency and questions about how best to provide the service. But then I think, to my mind, and maybe the thing I'm slightly more interested in, is this kind of second issue, which is about who should be providing this. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you might have some kind of moral or ethical qualms. And part of the problem is, particularly when you're delivering these big government services and you want it to be done efficiently, you want it to be done easily, that might nod towards these big companies. And all too often, it seems like government is happier to deal with the big corporations mm-hmm. than the small mm-hmm. enterprise. And it's quite understandable that it might be the case. It might be harder for the small enterprise to do these things. But then you get this kind of ancient question about the mix of government and business and corruption. You go back to Teddy Roosevelt and trust busting and all of these things. And there's a question, A, how does government stop that stuff from happening? And B, how does government not be part of the problem? And that, I think, is the difficult question to ask. And it's something that we all have to be on the eye to look out for, not just whether the results are efficient, but whether this is right and good in a legitimate, free political society.
To a certain extent, I have a certain level of sympathy for the government because recently, Chris Grayland, the Transport Secretary, as part of the government's planning for a no-deal Brexit, he came out and chose a ferry service that, in the event of a no-deal Brexit, would help with no-deal contingency planning. And it was a new British business that didn't actually have any ferries yet, but they bid for this contract and the government clearly thought, well, we can cut costs, etc. But the attack was, well, this is a new business, this venture might not ever get off of the ground, how dare you spend taxpayer money on something that might never, you know, come into fruition. So you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, really, aren't you?
Yeah, there's some truth in that. I mean, I, in struggling for a solution here, this is a bit of a cheeky solution rather than the one that I actually think is constitutionally viable, but I just wonder, and Art Laffer, the great Art Laffer, is one of the sort of advocates of this. You need to sort of tie the actual remuneration of politicians to the performance of the service. So an argument that I've always had with MPs who are supportive of HS2 is the minute that they sort of come back to me and say, oh, well, we've done all the numbers, it's definitely going to be profitable. The rate of return will be fantastic. To which my sort of response is, well, you won't mind if we gamble the entire parliamentary pension scheme on HS2 then. You're extremely confident that you will get great rates of return for your pension. So let's start with that as the first tranche of investment. And I raised the question about whether people might have voted a bit differently on funding HS2 when it was their pension on the line. Now, I say it's a bit of a cheeky answer because it's quite difficult to sort of work out how you would remunerate or punish Chris Grayling, depending on whether this company is a success or not with its ferries. But somehow or other, I wonder if we can embed that into the system because, I mean, a lot of this goes to the whole question of risk. Mm-hmm. People want risk completely taken out of any government service that we, you know, which goes to a lot of the arguments about, you know, the National Health Service, according to some people, shouldn't even procure anything from a profit-making company. You know, it shouldn't actually buy its stationery from Ryman's. We should have NHS forests and paper mills where they sort of grow their own trees. Now, we clearly don't want to go down that mania, that completely absurd maniacal route. But could we find a way of incentivising civil servants and politicians such that they have got some more skin in the game. Now, it's dangerous because then you're sort of converting them into speculators and you could see your politicians get very rich. I don't think they're on an incentive scheme, though, but in Singapore, the top civil servants are paid a hell of a lot more than we are in, ours are in Britain. It's seen as being the equivalent of a, you know, the head of a major business. And I just wonder whether we can change those remuneration decisions in order to at least get them thinking in terms of not what's going to be in the newspapers, but what they're how rich they will be in years to come.
Or at very least, we might hold them a bit more accountable when they do make bad decisions. We seem to be terribly bad in this country at actually doing that. I think another thing which struck me about the Grayling comment, which I think is a really big question of the day, is where he was talking about a new British business. There's this emphasis on British. And to my mind, the kind of opportunity we have with Brexit for internal and external competition will not be based on some kind of 18th century mercantilist kind of outlook. I mean, it's kind of crazy. If you look back in those days, you know, Adam Smith and Ricardo came along and bashed this stuff out of the ground, and you'd like to think that was the end of it. This idea of some kind of zero-sum game where you're, you know, your exports have always got to be greater than your imports and you've got to save your bullion in your pocket or whatever. But actually, we now see the growth of, you know, Trump and China. We see Marine Le Pen talking about l'intelligent protectionnisme. And I think part of what we've got to do as free marketeers is not just point out the economic benefits of free trade, which are boundless. You know, when Smith and Ricardo came along, this, you know, drove up living standards by the greatest increase anybody could ever imagine and continues to do so. But we've also got to realise that there are some cultural and social arguments that we need to get in on and we need to be able to provide some answers to, because some of these people are not just saying, hey, they're not necessarily kind of disagreeing with us about the free market benefits. They're saying there are some other reasons why you might want to keep this stuff in-house in the country, whether it's because I don't think anybody's suggesting that we should have British farmers because we want to be self-sufficient. We weren't self-sufficient in food even during World War II. They're saying, hey, we're the land of green and pleasant land or whatever. And similarly, you might say, well, I'm not going to outsource my army, not because it's going to be more efficient, but because, you know, sending off these foreign mercenaries might be dangerous. So I think we've got to recognise that sometimes we've got to make a bigger argument than just an efficiency-based argument. That argument, to my mind, wins knockdown. We've won that argument. We've got to realise that we're up against some new cultural and social arguments. And that's something that particularly at this time of Brexit, when we need to be outward-looking, we need to be competitive internally and externally. And part of that is addressing risk and realising that competitiveness is a good thing.
But the interesting thing there, and this is where I've heard Trump apologists make this argument to try and appeal to free marketeers, is if the rules of the game are seen as rigged, then allowing completely open free trade is, they would argue, it's not wholly my view, but they would argue, it's just exacerbating the problem. So, I mean, this came up on the whole business of the steel industry. You know, the argument goes, if the Chinese are massively subsidising their steel, there's a sort of implication for nefarious reasons, such that apparently in 20 years' time they will be monopoly providers of steel, and if anything wants anything metallic at all, they'll have to go and beg to the Chinese Communist Party to get it. But nevertheless, the argument was that's not a fair basis. You know, we're not competing like for like, so you can't have a more free trading arrangement. And that's quite a tricky one to deal with if the rules are rigged in some sort of fashion. I mean, I think the two, you know, the ways on that is we should try and unrig the rules that prevent our industries being competitive. But I think we have also got to have the argument, Rebecca, you're right, that I think I can imagine certain strategic industries that you wouldn't want to privatise. I think I probably don't want Carillion running our Trident nuclear missile system, for example. But too many things are put in the that is strategically important box.
Totally.
What, steel is not strategically important. There's a lot, oh, well, you can never know. I mean, there might be a war in 20 years' time and we might need to make bullets. And, you know, what are we going to do if we haven't got a steel plant in Port Talbot? To which the answer is, well, stockpile some steel now. I mean, you know, buy it now while it's cheap.
It's cheap enough, yeah.
and you know, store it somewhere and make bullets then. So although there are one or two, probably in our national security and defence, areas of genuine strategic significance, which you probably don't want. You don't want wholly marketised, right? You can't actually start a nuclear war for a profit. But in many other areas, whether it's agriculture or steel production, it usually tends to be the old-fashioned industries that are seen as strategic. Coal mining,
yeah,
steel, food, you know, whereas, you know, whatever, new tech businesses are not seen as strategic for some odd reason. And we've actually got to go out and win that argument.
How do we dispel the topsy-turvy suggestion that capitalists support crony-type capitalism, like you've both just said, and the kind of system that prevents the innovation that stems from competition that drives down prices, and that we favour bizarrely, it's suggested that we favour state intervention that protect those that are too big to fail.
I think that the answer to this is quite straightforward. We've got to do a better job of calling it out. In a small, very small number of ways, I've now started doing that in my role at the IEA. That's why I wrote my recent Times column on sort of crony capitalism and the problems here. But we probably, I mean, I think in terms of trying to win the argument on deregulation, which is an argument that's viciously difficult to win, we've got to make more of a play at pointing at regulations and not saying how daft they are, how stupid it is. You know, why does there have to be a regulation that you know, I don't know, that there needs to be a safety sign by every staircase or something? We would say how insane that is. But actually, I think we've got to show how these rules and regulations benefit the big guys. That what you are getting with more and more regulations and red tape is that you get companies that there is a cost for them adapting to them, but once they've mastered that gig, they have sort of pseudo-monopoly status. And I actually think we're not allowed, I think, to allow a single podcast to pass without somebody at least mentioning Brexit, right? But whatever the merits or demerits of the present arguments about it, it is unsurprising that the big companies are the most hostile to Brexit and smaller companies are more sympathetic to Brexit. Because once you've mastered exactly how to get around the EU regulation and rules on A, B, C, D, E, F and G, you've got that licked and nobody else has, you are losing a protective position potentially in the marketplace if those rules go or change.
Wasn't that the problem with Davos, though? The image of people hobnobbing with the likes of the CBI when actually they're, and then being told that when they need a second referendum and things like that. I think that's the optics, really. But Rebecca, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think one of the things I've been really pleased with that we've been doing with the FRIO initiative is we have been, from the outset, I mean, Lee Rowley and Luke Graham, our two co-chairs, wrote this opening, very passionate paper in which they attacked exactly this point about crony capitalism, about, you know, big business, vested interests, lobbying the government for regulations, barriers to entry. We all know this stuff happens, and I think too often politicians particularly who have seen themselves being on a sort of a business side rather than a free market side, we can argue all day about this. I don't have a problem with business, but I do have a problem with barriers to entry and, you know, holding down competition, whereas we all know that competition, you know, drives up standards, innovation meets demand, and this helps the consumer, it helps the people, it helps, you know, remember government is paid out of, it's the legitimisation of our agreeing to be part of an organised society. I mean, we are the state in the sense that I don't want to sound like a lefty, but we are, you know, we make up the nation, we pay the taxes, we are the people who should be, and businesses are made out of people as well. If you look at the tax burden, if you look at the regulatory burden, it's incredibly hard, particularly for these small businesses.
Too bloody high, yeah.
This is right, absolutely so. And, you know, particularly as we come out of Brexit, you know, these are the bedrock of our economy, these small businesses. We're great at startups, we need to get better at scale-ups. This is what we're going to need to flourish, but it's also just a question of what's right and what's good. And this kind of corruption, this kind of lobbying that goes on, which prevents competition, is bad, but I think it's also immoral. And I think we need to be calling this stuff out. We need to be sticking up for the stuff which brings about the good effects, but we also need to be sticking up for a system which is free and just and equal. And I think we could do a better job of that, to be honest.
I think that one of the problems here, however, is although we can use terms like corruption, etc., it is actually just people responding to rational incentives.
Yeah.
You know, if I run a big business and the regulator of that business is crucial to my profitability and possibly even to my viability or existence, and that's just the way it is, and my job is to try and grow my business, make it more profitable, increase its revenues, pay its shareholders better dividends, I would be a complete fool not to try and engage the regulator and get them off my back and bend them in a particular direction. Well, that's become part of running a business. You can't just shrug your shoulders at it. You'd be out of... So the businesses are responding to the incentives that actually exist and are there. They need to engage because the state is so colossal, not just in terms of what it spends, that's been a fairly consistent sort of 40% or so of GDP, but the rule books are becoming longer and longer and longer. And if that is a reality, Well, why wouldn't you, as a top businessman, pay $250,000 to go to Davos to try and bend the ear of a few people who could make a colossal difference to your bottom line?
Mm. That's right. And those businesses also have people who depend on them for their jobs, and they also provide us goods, you know, services and goods. I think what we need to do is we need to attack this idea that regulations are something nice. Mm-hmm. There is this sort of pervasive idea, the kind of the morality of regulation.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, I think, you know, we're going to recognise some places where regulation might be necessary. Mm-hmm. Even those of us who are the most hardcore free marketeers, if we agree with organised society, the same is the point about we're going to recognise some places for the state, whether it's defence or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. The point is that there is not some like moral imperative that everything needs to be regulated down. There are costs. There are costs in terms of hardworking people who are trying to have businesses and try to provide goods and services and try to be competitive to drive up standards. But there are moral costs too. And this is we need to be calling out the state. We need to be calling out the politicians who have an easy life, who enjoy their time spent with big business. It's easier for them to do it. And they are holding us all back. And it's wrong. It's bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. To end, I want to ask you, in a sentence, whether or not you're optimistic. Dr. Christian Niemitz is not as optimistic as Liz Truss, for example, that this my generation is the generation of Uber ride and Airbnb and Deliveroo eating freedom fighters, and actually they are more at ease with socialism than previous generations. I want to ask, if we don't win this argument, which could take years, are you optimistic that we have a free market future ahead of us as a country?
I am optimistic. In the medium to long term, not in the short term. I think too much can be read into opinion polls or a particular election in about how people voted in a particular way. And what I would say is that I think the only common thread you can pick up from it all is that large bulks of people are extremely disillusioned, whether that's young people in the United Kingdom or blue-collar workers in the Rust Belt in America. And they react in different ways they vote in different ways to reflect that. But the reason I'm optimistic is, in my view, the facts of life are libertarian. And the truth of the matter is that markets will always, unless you go to full-scale totalitarianism, ultimately find a way to win out. Sometimes it is like, you know, water, you know, a tide against a cliff. It takes a long, long time to chip away. It's not, but there is a magic to it. And I think as we get more and more used to being able to order goods and services at the flick of a switch, prices are becoming much more transparent now. I mean, we are closer in some areas like home insurance and utility bills to the perfect functioning market of the textbooks. But you can click a switch and see what the price is. That wasn't the case 20 years ago. So the facts of life are libertarian, by which I mean that technology is driving us forward in a way in which competition, full, free and fair competition, is the most likely way to deliver more and more goods and services. And if we can't win in that environment, we are doing something very, very badly wrong with our arguments.
Rebecca?
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think markets will win through because they, like Mark has put so eloquently, they bring about the best results. And we want that. We want that stuff. But also, it's just a part of human nature to want to, you know, exercise our autonomy, as free creatures, human beings with free will, and to make choices. And you can try and slam that down. You can try and control that. But in the end, I remain optimistic that we will battle back and win through.
Well, here's hoping free markets will win the day. Thank you very much, Rebecca and Mark, for joining me today.
Thanks,
sir.
For more podcasts, films, and reports, visit iea.org.uk.